Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. I'm your host, Jeremy Goldkorn, joined today by David Moser, academic director of CET, jazz musician, linguist, and all-round talented person. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much.
We're going to be doing something a little different today. As I mentioned in last week's podcast, Kaiser's dad, Guo Jingkai, is no longer with us. He was an amazing man whose life took him from pre-revolutionary China to Taiwan to the US and then back to the mainland, where he has lived on and off since the 1980s. Today, David and I will be talking to Kaiser all about his father and the two cultures and countries whose contradictions he tried to reconcile. Kaiser, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeremy.
Can we start with a brief sketch of your father's life, a potted biography, if you will?
Sure. I suppose my father's life can be divided into three major chapters. The first, of course, is his early childhood and the years all the way up through his undergraduate years, up until from his birth in 1932 all the way up until 1948 when he left for Taiwan. I suppose that's subsumed still in the China chapter, the first chapter of his life. So he was there until 1956 when he graduated from college and had done a year of military service. And then in 1956, he moved to the United States to pursue his graduate studies and lived in the States, gaining American citizenship in the early 1970s, and really lived there, at least owned a home and spent most of his time in the States until 1999. After 1996, though, he had spent more and more of his time in China, and he actually started a business here in China. Didn't really go back to live in the United States until the very end of his life, just this year, and had three marvelous weeks living in the San Francisco Bay Area before his final hospitalization. So, yeah, those are the three chapters, sort of a China chapter, a U.S. sojourn that lasted quite a while, and then back to the United States for the final sort of episode of his life.
And can I ask, fast forward a little bit, why did he come back to China?
I think that...
to the mainland, maybe,
sure.
I should say.
You know, he had made his first trip back in 1975 and was always a very deeply patriotic person in the best sense of the word. That is that, he had a profound love for the country of his birth and had an earnest desire to see China bettered in the world, believed all along, really, that for all the good that he could do in the U.S., he would be able to do incomparably more if he brought his skills as an engineer back to China. And so really, from the mid-late 1970s all the way up until his death, he really labored pretty tirelessly for ultimately the goal of China's betterment. And so, yeah, I think from as far back as I can remember, it was part of a project of his to keep his children connected to their Chinese heritage. And, he was always one for teaching by example. And there was no better example than him, pulling up roots and stakes in a very comfortable existence that he had in the U.S. and coming back to China, often to be, mugged by realities and by, unscrupulous business associates, and had a very tough time of things for many years here in China, but never really gave up, never gave up on his goals of improving things in China.
Even when they didn't want to be improved.
Right, stubbornly resisted improvement.
So your father sort of came into political awareness during the anti-Japanese war, and then went through all the changes up till liberation, and then was in Taiwan. Could you maybe, I've heard you talk a little bit about his politics, but I mean, could you maybe describe his shifting politics and the sort of social forces that he was living through that led to these changes or these different ideas?
Sure. I guess by way of preface, I had been for the last 3 years or so interviewing him pretty extensively, and recording the interviews and taking pretty copious notes. And he's a very gifted storyteller, and he could be drawn out on all sorts of different topics and made to sort of paint on all the color that I wanted, all the texture and the nuance. And of course, politics was a big part of that. He was the son of a very well-known historian, a major intellectual of the Nationalist period, Guo Tingyi, who was an historian who was the founding director of the Academia Sinica in Taiwan. And I think that his politics were shaped in large part by his reaction to the inequities that he saw in the Kuomintang period. Like so many of the other children of Kuomintang intellectuals, he leaned pretty left. And when he moved to the United States, I think up until the time that he came to the States, he would have described himself as pretty apolitical. You know, he had ideas, but he wouldn't have described them as well formed. I mean, he was quite young, and I mean he would have been the first to tell you that he was, you know, woefully ignorant about, you know, larger and more complex political ideas, and wouldn't have regarded himself as someone who was particularly well schooled in it. I mean, he was an engineer. He wasn't you know, somebody who spent a lot of time reading political theory. Even in his sort of left period, which under, you know, very much under the influence of my mother, who had a similar background to him, but sort of more reason to be resentful of the Kuomintang. The both of them, after the 72 Nixon visit, they were part of the Chinese American community that really was excited by the new opening, really excited by the prospect of normalization of relations.
Because if I may interrupt, how unusual was that at that time for somebody come from Taiwan?
I don't think it was that unusual. I think, certainly most of the people that I knew growing up would have fit into that camp. I mean, my parents' close associates. Now, I understood there was a very big divide. There were a lot of people on the other side of it. People that, you know, my parents sometimes would broke with them over issues related to Taiwan versus the mainland. So it wasn't altogether unusual for them to lean left, as far left as they went. I mean, my father was an enthusiast for a while. He now, or later, I mean, after having actually lived in China, after his first trip, really, he was disabused of many of his idealistic notions about what Mao had done, and came to be a very big critic and a big supporter of the Deng Revolution or the Deng Counter-Revolution, and was enthusiastic about the direction that China was then taking. But even that, he became pretty profoundly disillusioned with, and came to see that there far-reaching systemic change needed to happen in China. And toward the end, he was very, very critical. Was always somebody who embraced, or certainly in the last 20 years of his life, somebody who very much believed that China needed pluralistic political reform, that they needed things that you know, we would describe as the universal values, you know, freedom of press and a meaningful rule of law and things like that. So, yeah, he really became a pretty ardent critic and a very vocal one.
And this is after his experience in the U.S., where he became, you know, I guess, politicized in the U.S. as well, along Republican Democrat lines.
Sure. I mean, he was, from the time that he started paying attention to American politics, I mean, he was very much wrapped up he was ardently a Democrat. That is, really, from the Kennedy days, I grew up with a bronze bust of JFK in my house, and they very much romanced on Camelot and were very taken with the Democrat Party. I mean, they took part in fundraisers for McGovern and for they'd gained citizenship in the very early 1970s. So the McGovern campaign and the Carter campaign, especially in 76, and then again for Carter's reelection. I remember that was, you know, sort of my first participation in any kind of political events, fundraisers. We had Rosalind Carter, for example, come. And I served, you know, hors d'oeuvres as an eighth grader. It was a lot of fun.
I should say to the audience, the listening audience, that we have had the pleasure of reading some notes and sketchy biographical notes that Kaiser has been in the process of compiling through interviews. So we do have a little bit of knowledge that doesn't come from just direct interaction. But I thought it was very amusing when he first came to the U.S. having only experience in two sort of totalitarian forms of government, that his first impression of American democracy was how wasteful it was and how inefficient.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that was his first impression. I mean, if I can tell one story, his first encounter with Americans at all, this is something that I really, drew out of him and at some length. It was during the war, of course. His family had fled Nanjing, where my grandfather was teaching, and they went inland. This is in August of 1937, so well ahead, actually, ahead of the Battle of Shanghai. But he'd seen the writing on the wall. My grandfather had a knack for knowing when things were coming. He was, even before the Marco Polo Bridge incident, hot war was looming, and they began evacuating all the precious artifacts of the Palace Museum at that point already. So he was part of a group of scholars that worked on moving everything out of the Gugong to Chongqing.
So he was your grandfather. That's
amazing. He was part of that.
Yes, he was. That's incredible. And he's. I mean, another podcast about my grandfather, maybe. Yeah. But he moved the family there. Again, he moved the family from the mainland to Taiwan. Actually, in very early 1948, he had actually in 1947 had been. Again, part of the advance team, he went there to speak to a Kuomintang general who was already ensconced in Taiwan, a general named Chen Chen, who to lay the groundwork for for moving what was then Southeastern University to Taiwan. So he managed to secure a big plot of land for the new campus of Zhongyang Daxue. And so yeah, he was had a knack for staying ahead, but. Getting back to your question about his encounters with Americans in 1942, he had his first encounters with Americans. It was shortly after Pearl Harbor, and there was a lot of excitement about American participation. And the first thing that he saw were the trucks. He lived in Shapingba, which is a district now of Chongqing. It's sort of the university district of Chongqing. Lived in this neighborhood called Songlingpo. And there was construction going on of a large highway, which I think was part of the Burma Road. American trucks were there. It was rare enough for him to see an internal combustion engine vehicle. I mean, automobiles were rare enough as it was in Chongqing of the early 1940s. But there he was, seeing just fleets, dozens of these five-axle, enormous, shining trucks doing this road work. He never really got close to the Americans at that point. But his first real encounter was in the summer of 42, him and a bunch of the other boys, all of them, 9 and 10 years old, were watching as a group of American GIs had made a sort of makeshift baseball diamond near the university on a field there, and they were batting a ball around, and they were tossing a ball, and he was watching. Two of them were standing there, and they were eating peanuts. Peanuts in Chongqing are excellent. Sichuan peanuts are the best. And they had these peanuts in the shell, and they were cracking the shells open and eating the peanuts and taking them out of their left pocket. And then they looked around and found no place to dispose of the shells, and they put them in their right pocket. And my father watched them do this again and again. And any normal Chinese person would just throw them on the ground. I mean, it wasn't like I can't imagine the pitch was particularly neat or anything. but my father thought at the time, my God, these people are so civilized. I must go live among them.
Learn their ways. Right,
learn their mysterious ways. And his first impressions of America were actually, I started off this whole project thinking that I was, and I heard about this episode. I mean, I heard in 1956, my father finished his year of military service in Taiwan. All the graduates of the 1955 class at Taida in mechanical engineering had been sent to do military service on the same Air Force base in Taichung, where they were translating manuals for some American planes. And, he didn't see any action or anything like that. But he did look very neat in his military outfit. There's great pictures of him. He got on the same charter flight to the U.S. to start graduate school as over 90 of his classmates. These people included people like Tian Changling, who would be the chancellor of UC Berkeley later. Many people who went on to be, you know, major department heads in different engineering disciplines and in physics. Many people who founded quite large and quite successful enterprises in America. And I thought that this was, you know, a great sort of starting point. And I've tracked down quite a number of these people and talked to them. But I guess the original idea was to also find that parallel with my own life, their children, how many of them had come back to China in a sort of kind of mirror image of the lives that our parents had led. And I was actually disappointed to find so few of them that actually had made that same kind of mirror image transposition back to China.
Most of them stayed in the U.S.
Yeah, most of them stayed in the U.S. And very few of them were engineers, to the disappointment
of their parents. But is there a reason why that plane load of, you know, ex-mainland refugees, essentially, from Taiwan, not refugees, but exiles.
That one flight.
I mean, you know, what was special about that group of people?
I think that so they were all Weishengren. They were, as you say, all mainland refugees. There weren't any. There were very few Taiwanese. My father said at Taida, ironically, and so yeah. I mean, the whole world he lived in was these, you know, these mainlanders essentially. Many of them had actually gone to the same high school. Many of them had actually lived with him as a, you know, in the same compound as him when he was a child in Chongqing. So a lot of these people's stories, you know, really parallel my father's very closely. I think what was special about them was that, it was interesting because they didn't really know what they were going to do. But in 1955, the first class that had gone over, the first class to have graduated from Taida in that discipline, discovered that there were all these scholarships available, that there were all these free rides at these big, you know, state schools in the States. And it basically became the thing to do. Everyone went. A lot of the women, and you know, this is a very, very gender segregated society still, got nursing scholarships and went to the United States to study nursing. But the men all went into engineering. There's a huge crew of them, and you know, they did have a particular set of experiences. Like I said, many of them were the offspring of either intellectuals, so their parents were college professors or politicos. Some of them were from, you know, senior military people as well. But yeah, they were a really remarkable bunch with some very, I mean, they had lived many lifetimes already. I mean, the experiences that they had had growing up during the war, during the Civil War, were really, really quite remarkable and story-worthy, yeah.
So a close-knit group and a small sort of elite group that probably doesn't exist so much anymore because there's such a great influx of immigration.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. This is not in the sort of memoirs that you had, but I had a question, maybe a little bit off topic, but he was in the United States then in the 50s and 60s.
That's right.
In some ways, mainland China was a kind of a black box. No one really, you know, there weren't a lot of reporters here. What were his what were his channels of information about what was happening in mainland China, and how accurate were they?
Right, he really knew very, very little. I mean, most of what he heard. I mean, he was ferociously anti-communist, of course, by the when he arrived in the first few years after arriving.
But he hated but both he, of he them,
had,
right?
Right. He had right an equal loathing for. I mean, because the Kuomintang that he had seen. I mean, let's remember. Like, so he after the surrender, they remained in Chongqing for a while, sort of cleaning up, and then. In the summer of 45, the summer of 46, he spent a summer in his Laojia, in his hometown, in Wuyang County in Henan.
Near Kaifeng.
Not near Kaifeng. It's actually in the south of Henan, in Wuyang County, near the city of Luohe. Then went to Nanjing, and Nanjing during the Civil War. They experienced hyperinflation after, the KMT was defeated in some major battles that happened in northern Jiangsu province. Nanjing was flooded with refugees, and he saw tremendous inequality He saw just gross incompetence and I mean, experienced the sort of hyperinflation you read about in Weimar Germany. And this was deeply unsettling to him. He's always been somebody with a very strong sense of social justice, which I think led him to like the communists later on. A couple of things really resonate with me. One was that my grandfather, who would have been considered left Kuomintang, I mean, he actually took part in the Northern Expedition, but was quietly very critical, even though he had been very closely attached to. In fact, he was the private tutor to Jiang Jingguo, my grandfather was, and but he was very critical of Guo Tingyi.
Yeah.
He was extremely critical of the nationalists privately, and he said that all of his best students joined the Communist Party, and he said that is very significant. However, he himself did not subscribe to communism, to Marxism-Leninism. He thought that it was dangerously naive. That the thing that he would often repeat is that people do not change their souls overnight. They don't change. I mean, their mentality cannot change so quickly, and that you're dangerously naive to believe that that's possible. And so when in the 1970s, my parents would, sing the praises of the party, I mean, they often got in quite heated arguments because my grandfather said, you're being duped by this. This isn't,
this new socialist man is impossible.
Right, yeah,
this, he had also immigrated to the U.S. at that point.
Yeah, he had... Another interesting story because like I said, he was fairly critical, and he was somebody who had a Western, if you will, a historiographic sense, was somebody who, believed that, history, the endeavor of history was always tied very closely to statecraft, of course. And he was, closely tied to it as well, but he was very critical and tried to be as objective as possible in his own scholarship. That didn't endear him to either side, really, and for many years, but his books were banned both in Taiwan and in the mainland, and the only place where they were published was in Hong Kong, and the only place where him and many other scholars of his generation, he felt like the only place where he could actually pursue more or less objective scholarship was in the U.S., and so he spent years at Harvard, at the Harvard Yenching Institute, and it was at the East-West Center in Hawaii, and lived out the rest of his life at Columbia. He had an apartment on Riverside Drive or near Grant's tomb, where we used to visit him when I was a kid. So, he was, persona. I mean, his studies, at least, were his scholarly work was not acceptable to martial law era Taiwan.
Can we go back again a little bit? Because your father had the extraordinary experience of living in wartime Chongqing.
Yeah, I think it's one of the more dramatic episodes of his life. I mean, from the time I was quite young, he would tell us about that, of the experience of the bomb shelters and, his whole routine. I remember just hearing about like the warning system that they lived on Sunlingpo, but only 200 or 300 meters away from them, there was this hill. There was a station where there were large visible lanterns that they would hang. And so they would pull up one lantern that was sort of a qingbao yugao, to warn people that the Japanese planes had taken off and they were heading toward Chongqing to make a bombing run. And after the second lantern was lit, they would head to the bomb shelter. And the bomb shelter was only maybe a half mile away from where they lived. But my father's duties were to pile up his dad's manuscripts and then put his little baby brother on his back and jog off to the shelter. That was his responsibility, was to keep the
two Balber, right, the manuscripts, exactly, and the
son, right. And they would come back and sometimes would find that the bombs had fallen on their compound and the tile roof would be completely scattered, and they would spend days reassembling the roof. Fortunately, not all the tiles were cracked or anything. They were able to put the roof back together. But you know, there are all sorts of stories that he told. Some of the more memorable ones were about, for example, watching dogfights over the skies of Chongqing. My father remembers this, I think incorrectly, as having actually been the Flying Tigers. I don't think that it could have been the Flying Tigers. I mean, from my researches, it doesn't look like during those years there were any dogfights involving Americans. But he did see some. There were certainly, after 42, there were some dogfights in the skies. And
he's how old then?
So he was, I mean, this is, he was born in 32, so he was a 10-year-old boy.
10 years, okay.
And he would watch them, you know, just roll out from behind banks of clouds and descend. I mean, they were much faster. These are you know, good Douglas P9s or whatever. They were these very, very powerful American engines, and they would just shred the Japanese. They never stood a chance. He said he never saw an American plane down, but they were, you know, would often see Japanese planes go down, and the bombers would then just unload their payloads ineffectively and then just sort of bank back and head back toward the occupied areas. But when they would down a pilot, people would instantly charge toward where he'd parachuted. Everyone would descend on it. And often, you know, they would find the guy and beat him. My father never saw that. He said he was only able to make it once to the location of a down pilot. And by the time he got there, Japanese pilot, who was immaculately dressed, really neatly pressed flight suit, you know, really quite dignified, no headgear at all. His helmet or his scarf would have been lost, but he was being marched under arms to who knows where. And my father just was witness to this. And normally people would throw stones and throw sticks, but nobody dared because he was sort of under guard. There were a lot of armed men who made it pretty clear that he wasn't to be fucked with. Yeah, he told me about, you know, his just abiding hatred for the Japanese, and how he said that probably none of us, his sons, would ever understand how anyone could have no higher desire in life than to strap himself up with explosives, roll under a Japanese tank and pull pin on a grenade. That's what he aspired to do. He said, you'll never know that feeling. But this is the man who in 1972 bought a Datsun 240Z and was completely over it. He actually talked a lot about Japanese friends that he made when he was a graduate student and how they would assiduously avoid the topic of the war. But he had quite a bit of admiration for the way they comported themselves. Though he said he would experience Japanese people one-on-one, both of them speaking in rather halting English to one another, communicating sometimes in you know, commonly understood Chinese characters, kanji. He one night was invited to eat at the Japanese overseas student's dorm and found a very, very different reception. These same people who individually had been super warm to him really kind of were very, you know, baltoir. They all kind of fell into line and were extremely cold to any of the Chinese students who were there.
What about mingling with the, well, I guess at that time there weren't very many in academia, that many mainland Chinese, but I mean, how did he interact with the, you know, or what was his sense of personal identity? Let's put it that way.
I mean, right. That's a good question. I mean, it's something that evolved. He says that evolved quite gradually over time. You know, when did he start feeling like he was an American? He said that it really had entirely to do with his command of the language. That the more he understood about his surroundings, I mean, his early encounters with Americans were always very, very positive. I mean, you cite maybe the one negative thing that he ever said, but, you know, he would, you know, go to the Big Bear grocery store, the supermarket in Columbus, Ohio, where he was doing his master's degree, and would pile up his groceries at the checkout and find that he was short cash, and the cashier would just simply say, "Oh, that's okay. Just write me an IOU." And you know, the everyone was just extraordinarily nice. He said he never experienced anything like racial prejudice. Of course, everyone knew that anyone who was a Chinese student there at that time was from free China, right?
Yeah.
Was from free China, and there was an awful lot of sympathy. Americans were he said, extremely welcoming, and really were really curious about his stories, and they had that same sort of post-war, you know, camaraderie that, you know, together we vanquished. So his overall experiences with America were extremely positive. That didn't prevent him, of course, from having a deep attachment to his native China.
So he goes from China seeing America from afar as, I guess, almost a, you know, a young boy in mythological terms. This was modernity. This was power. This was freedom. And then he's there, and he lives the American dream somewhat. Right. Starts to raise a family, and then you come into the picture. What is his? How does that tale work out?
So, I mean, I think that there's one sort of lasting legacy, at least for me. I don't know if it's the same for all the rest of my siblings who have varying degrees.
Yeah,
I have three siblings, right? I have an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister. But really only two of us had any long periods of time spent in China. My sister lived in Beijing for about 10 years. She started a yoga studio here. But she never attained, for example, literacy in Chinese. She was never somebody. I mean, she dated Chinese men. She had a Chinese life here. She ran a wedding magazine here, which is kind of a hard thing to do when you're an illiterate. But
oh yeah, I remember. Yeah, you remember wedding that. Magazine, right.
My younger brother spent some time here. He actually started during the .com boom. He got very excited and started a Chinese sort of financial services website out here. But neither of them had quite the attachment I did. But getting back to my father's, you know, legacy, if anything, was he really made me believe that it was possible to be of both worlds. That I think he gave me this tremendous gift. I think he gave it all to all of his children, this idea, which, whether or not it was true, I always felt to be true, that the inheritance of the what I would regard, rightly or wrongly, as the two great civilizations of this world, those both belong to me without the need for any kind of sophisticated justification for it or anything. I can reach out, and the whole legacy of Euro-America belongs to me by right, by my birth in the United States and my citizenship, but also China. Mm-hmm. That was also sort of mine. If I wanted it, I can, you know, claim to be an heir to that civilization as well.
Kaiser, about that, you've talked in the past about being sometimes finding yourself in the situation where you feel as though, you know, you're sort of stuck between China and America.
Stuck is one side of the coin,
and you're perceived as by either side as not belonging. Whereas you feel that you belong to both sides.
Right.
You had quite a nice metaphor about islands and peninsulas, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think I said something like, you know, if you live on an island between two banks of a river, from the one bank you look like sort of a promontory of the other side, and from the other you look like a promontory of that.
Right.
Right.
So did your father ever have the same feeling?
I think less so. I don't think that he was. He rarely had his loyalties, as they were, ever called into question. You know, but part of it is because he didn't wade thickly into the political fray, the way I tend to do masochistically. I mean, I like to get into it. I like to talk about U.S.-China relations. I like to talk about you know, Chinese politics. That's what this whole show was all about, right?
Yeah, and you've worked in media. I mean, communications.
So maybe he didn't feel it as, and that was always kind of comforting for me to be able to go to him and to talk about the pressures that I was sometimes under. And I mean, I could always see him as somebody who was very comfortable straddling these two worlds.
It's interesting because you describe the difference in your siblings. The usual sort of ABC pattern is that they grow up speaking kitchen Chinese and they know some culture, but they sort of wear the language and culture like a suit of ill-fitting clothes,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And what you see this thing in Chinese, we talk about rentong, you know, like, mm-hmm. say assimilation or identifying with the culture, but there's seldom a case where there's a kind of a composite identity, where you feel like, as you described it,
right,
part of the both heritages. And that must be because of you had a special relationship with your father that most other ABCs, in fact, don't even have.
Yeah, I think he's, very much to his credit, he did do a lot to make us proud of our Chinese heritage. A story I like to tell, I mean, at the kitchen table where we did all of our serious talking, he had this whiteboard next to it, and he would just, anytime we would be talking, and almost every conversation, he would suddenly get to his feet and say, "中国人有一句话说," and then he would write, you know, an idiom on the board and explain it to us, or he would explain this Chinese saying that was always perfectly apt, and that was just one of the many things that he did to sort of make us proud of our Chineseness. He told us a lot of stories, you know. He got me hooked on 三国演义, you know. Mm-hmm. Would always talk to us about, you know, the adventures of Liu Bei and Zhang Fei and Guan Yu, and you know, we were always hearing stories about Zhuge Liang, and I mean, I knew who all of these characters were as a boy without having ever actually read it. I mean, we had these comic books that you may have seen that were printed in the 60s, and I just loved the art in them, and I would flip through them, you know, being able to recognize every fourth or fifth character or whatever, but still.
These things that are collector's items now.
Yeah, you know. I've got a good set at home still. Yeah, they're good, really good stuff. The whole bicultural ambition, it's interesting. Yeah, like you say, the typical ABC pattern. I look at how the three of us boys and my sister turned out, and my older brother, I mean, if I may, if I don't want to sound like, you know, really kind of essentialist here or anything, but he has probably the most psychologically Chinese, if there's such a thing. He had the imprint of Confucianism, just sort of. I had a history professor, Charles Hedke, when I was a graduate student, who described my father as a Confucian. That was really good. He's one of these techno-mandarins, right, or something like that. It was really apt. But my older brother, it was very much like that. I mean, he has still, I think his ethos is best described as Confucian. He has this kind of, you know, deeply humanist streak in him. He's, you know, very secular, but he's also got that kind of patriarch thing. My dad had all these little things that he did to instill what I now recognize to be kind of Chinese values. One of them I thought was interesting. We know we were of means, and we had a good sized house. There would have been bedrooms enough for all the boys, but instead we all slept in one very small room about the size of this studio, in kind of the Brady Bunch configuration of the bunk beds, and then a single bed where my older brother slept, and then another room which was our study room, and another room for play. But the study. So the whole point was to kind of make us be able to deal with one another. He really wanted a kind of communitarian sense. And there were rules like television, right? My dad being an engineer, he was able to install this very clever key switch on the family television, this big Zenith thing, you know, one of those cumbersome wooden cabinets. And he had a rule. We could only watch 5 hours of elective television a week. And the rule was that, well, first of all, any news, anything on PBS, public broadcasting, anything like Nova, or, I mean, that was on PBS, but any, you know, Cosmos, Carl Sagan, anything that was educational, any National Geographic specials, those didn't count against it. Those were anything that we could make a case for being educational didn't count against it. And neither did certain television shows. And the ones that he exempted were David Carradine in Kung Fu, which was really funny, right? And maybe, I think maybe more tellingly, Bonanza. You guys remember
the cowboy? Oh. Yeah, exactly. We had that even in apartheid South Africa,
right?
Yeah. But that makes sense because that's very Confucian.
It's extremely Confucian. So you think about this. I mean, if you think about Ben Cartwright and his three sons and their relationship with the law, right? I mean, it was like family first and then the state. You know, your allegiance to the family was always, and so I always thought that there was something about that. And aside from kind of a passing resemblance between I always thought my father was kind of a Chinese Lauren Green to begin with, but
the gray hair and everything.
Oh, just the kind of the eyebrows and the gravitas and all that. Right. Yeah. I mean, he did never sling dog food commercials or anything, but, yeah, it was or sling guns or anything, but yeah, I think that says a lot. And you know, so the other thing about the 5 hours was anything that we did want to watch, we had to have perfect accord. We if there was any noticeable dissension, we weren't allowed to watch. And so, I mean, we all had to at least appear to be in agreement as to how we were going to spend this hour of our precious viewing time. And I'm not sure. I mean, that, I thought
so. It wasn't a democracy then.
No.
It was conformity.
It was intended to sort of teach us to
unity.
Yeah, right. That kind of harmony. Yeah.
So it was up to the kids whether or not to absorb that rich stew of Chinese memes that you were growing up with, right?
Right.
And you chose to dive into it more than the other kids.
I did, I think, in a very real sense, because I needed something to stand out from my very talented siblings. I mean, they're both exceptional minds. My brothers. I mean, my sister came along later, so I mean, I don't mean to exclude her from this at all. But you know, for a long time, it was just the three boys. And sandwiched in the middle as I was, and with nothing really, you know, that marked me as special, except a weird name, I had to find something that was going to, you know, win the favor of my parents. And it was, you know, attachment to China for me. Mm-hmm. I was the kid who would, you know, who would memorize these songs from these albums printed literally on red vinyl, and you know, they would be like, you know. Right. You know the red songs. I mean, I'd learn all this stuff, you know, commit it to memory.
But this is part of my confusion a little bit, that this was a China that came into being after he had left Taiwan.
Right.
You know, how does this work out?
It's something that he was embarrassed about later, of course. You know, feeling like he had gone and been shown the Potemkin villages and been sort of duped. He had his suspicions, but he was very proud. He really thought that, I mean, because the Potemkin villages that he saw were very, very different from the real mess of the last time he had been in China, which was, you know, this is after the Battle of Taizhuang and all these refugees pouring in and, you know, Nanjing about to fall, just absolutely chaotic. And they were quite poor. They were, you know, they just didn't have it very good. And just coming back to Beijing, even in the 1970s, and just seeing, you know, these tree-lined streets with these, you know, neat buildings set back from them, and, you know, these rectilinear roads and, right. and if not wealth, at least, and or prosperity, at least there wasn't...
Order.
There was order and no visible malnutrition or anything, so it was very different.
Well, that gets to just an arc of history question that I was wondering about him, because there's something in the memoirs about this conflict between, or the sense of China as being there was modernity and then there's China, that how can China be synonymous with modernity, because there was this conflict. It was China was the essence of old-fashioned, quaint, retrograde thinking and everything.
Right.
And so the question I have is, your father sort of went from pre-revolution China, came and then to rich capitalist America, and in the interim, China became modern and became rich, or at least rich, you know, much richer than it was then. What was his reaction to that change? Was there pride? Was it a feeling that, you know, they've finally accomplished what I always expected they would? Or was it a mixed bag?
Very much a mixed bag. I mean, there was certainly a lot of pride, but there was also a great degree of criticism. I mean, he always encouraged me, up until the end, he thought that I need to take my children out. And he wasn't so much worried about the pollution. He was worried about the sort of... moral vacuum of China. He really thinks that, you know, in some of our final conversations, he was t- talking to me about different places where he thinks I should raise children. He said, you know, somewhere where they can still ride their bicycles and play kickball in the street. Somewhere, I don't know if that America exists anymore, but you know, he's pretty horrified by
the America of IOUs at the supermarket doesn't exist anymore.
Right, right. I mean, I think he always clung to this idea that somewhere there was this sort of Garrison Keillor kind of America. Is that reference lost on you, Karen?
No, it's not, actually. Okay. My father was a big Garrison Keillor fan in the 80s. So
right.
It's one of those odd, you know, your culture is everywhere.
Yeah, our culture is everywhere.
When he arrived in the 50s, was the Leave It to Beaver? It was
very
sort
much
of
leave
that,
it,
that
yeah,
mythical,
I mean,
you know, post-World War II boom, baby
exactly.
boomers.
Exactly. I mean, America was at that point just, you know, as you know, it was a very earnest and trusting and, I mean, at least in you know, the places where he was, in Columbus, Ohio, then at Stanford University, and then later at
Berkeley. It's still a very earnest and trusting society. And
relatively, I think it is.
Compared to anything I've experienced anywhere else on the planet, I have to say.
So, yeah, I mean, back to your question. I mean, he's very, very worried for China. He remained all the way up to the end very, very worried for the future of China. One thing that he always said was that the cost, there's always a price to pay for the kind of radical change that he thought was necessary. He wasn't talking about political revolution necessarily, but he was talking about some, you know, pretty profound system change. Now I'd mischaracterize him to say that he was some deep political thinker, but he did tell me one thing that is always sort of, it was always a bone of contention between us. He thought the price only goes up, the price that that the society will pay in blood or in chaos or in you know, severe dislocation, that cost will go up only. And that was his case for wanting, to push for more rapid change, even if the near term cost was going to be high, that the cost will only get higher, and that's something I never agreed with him on. I still don't necessarily agree with him. I think that we don't know where the cost curve actually goes, but yeah, I respected that idea, and I thought that. You know, it was something I should certainly turn over in my head a lot.
Do you think his heart is in China, Taiwan, or the United States?
Well, I mean, his ashes will be in China and the United States.
Why not Taiwan?
Is it
time too short? Or
no, I think there was a lot about Taiwan that he admired. I mean, you know, he spent he took ill in very early January when we were on a family trip to Taiwan. I talked about that trip on this podcast. He really liked an awful lot about Taiwan. He liked the high degree of trust among people. There was an awful lot that he came to very much appreciate about. I mean, the healthcare system, for instance, which never really let him down. It was very excellent care that he received while he was there. But he also understood that there were anomalies about Taiwan while he was never one of these people who believed that Chinese were somehow, I mean, he was never an essentialist. He never believed that there was a timeless and unchanging political culture that would hobble China forever and keep it from ever becoming democratic. He never believed that for a moment, and he didn't need to point to Taiwan as an example of that, but nor did he think that you could point to Taiwan and say, well, if they did it, so can we right away. He understood there was a lot of distance between A and B, you know, getting there, and that Taiwan had the advantages of the protection of the American Seventh Fleet. They had tremendous riches, the entire, you know, hard currency reserve of the mainland that went with them, the best and brightest of scholars and engineers, and so many of them who were attached to the Kuomintang government went and lorded it over what was essentially a subject population, that China had been devastated by the war, whereas the infrastructure in the war and the civil war, whereas the infrastructure in Taiwan laid down, you know, over 50 years of Japanese occupation remained more or less intact. And that there was a leg up. It wasn't a fair, simple, you know, comparison that could be made. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he had, like I said, he had a lot of admiration for Taiwan, and he traveled there frequently. He was very proud also of the accomplishments, especially after the lifting of martial law.
Well, his cohorts had also, you know, that's a very important time in school.
That's right.
And come from there, so that's, I assume, right, that those were one of the cores of his, you know, his Guanxi network, or his, you know, his friend circle of friends in the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's very much the case. I think, I mean, it's interesting to see, though, so many of his cohort. I mean, if you look at his formative years, I mean, these are like his days in Nanjing. I love to talk about those years. There are a few, I think, eras that are really, he always told stories from. One was from that summer in Wuyang County, between the war and the civil war, you know, the summer of 1946. He so often just told stories from that 1 3 or 4 month stretch. Mm-hmm. The other was from Nanjing, during his years in junior high. Who knows? Time where they would chrome up their bikes and they'd fight with the other street gangs, and he was a kind of young ruffian, I guess, a young tough kind of leader of this little bicycle-born street gang, a real handsome guy back then. But I love hearing about his other the guys in the pictures. I mean, because he stayed in touch with them, like Du He Rong, guy who's here in Beijing, a guy named Cao An. I mean, all these other these people who some of them were and ended up in military intelligence here. I think Du He Rong, who I saw very frequently, I still see, I'm sure I'll see a lot more of, fought in Korea, had a pretty illustrious military career in China. He has people who were friends who ended up simply as high school teachers, who didn't do well. People who suffered very badly during the Cultural Revolution. It's like from that one node of my father and the people who he knew growing up. I always felt like I could see like this, the whole tapestry. I mean, just from this one node.
Yeah, that's something that comes across in reading these sketches that you gave us, is that your father was a mensch. He instinctively sided with the morally, you know, correct side ever, you know, since the Nanjing years, is, you know, later on, even all the anecdotes and things
I don't want to make a hagiography, I mean, out of this.
Well, this might be the time to do it, if there's any time.
Sure, sure. let me just first preface this by saying that, you know, he wasn't by far, I mean, he was not perfect, as near to perfect as, I mean, any human being I've ever known, but his imperfections were also maybe his strengths. I mean, he was ferociously rational. I mean, and that drove my mother crazy, of course, because he always sort of found absolution in his rationalist viewpoints. And he was mm-hmm. always so cocksure. I mean, he was maddeningly logical. He was always very athletic, always captained the sports teams.
Oh, that's right. He wasn't just a nerd. He was also very athletic.
Yeah, and he also, you know, was good with the ladies, apparently. Mom, I'm sorry about that. I got all a down low on, like, his early girlfriends and stuff like that. It was really nice.
Nice for you, but let's leave that off the public record.
Yeah, I'll leave it off the public record. You're right, though. He had an instinctive sense for justice.
Yes. Justice, yes.
Yeah, and whether it's social justice or even just sort of justice dispensed within the family.
What you described as his despair of China was for the moral vacuum.
Yeah, sort of, it really was. Yeah. I mean, but at the same time, another thing that he always said, and I asked him about this later in his life. I said, on a car trip, I remember very distinctly talking to him about communism. This was during a time when I was sort of enamored with it. I thought that, I mean, I my my early brushes with Marxist theory led me to believe that, you know, his theory about the exploitation, the essentially exploitative nature of capitalism, where it was correct. And my father said that he believed then, and even to the end, that the moral vision, you know, this sort of belief in the genius and generosity of mankind, that was at the heart of Marxism, was a more beautiful vision to him. He always thought that it was a better one, but that was tempered, of course, by his realization that not all people could be like that. But I mean, I wrote this on Facebook when I was writing a little remembrance of my dad, and it seemed to resonate with a lot of people. Like, the one lesson that he taught me that I've been deeply appreciative of is he said that in life, one rarely encounters bleak moral decisions between, you know, good and evil. It's never like that. The junctures that one finds oneself at daily, hourly, are between doing something petty, behaving in a petty way, or being sort of more generous in spirit, more magnanimous, and that you encounter that constantly, and that is when you need to choose correctly. And that if you always, and this is what he always said, is you need to recognize pettiness in yourself and learn to despise it. And if you do that consistently and choose the high road, you will be a good man. You will be a good person.
Thank you very, very much for sharing some of your dad's life with us and our listeners. And I hope you've all enjoyed it. And we dedicated last week's podcast to your dad. I guess we don't have to dedicate it again this week because it's all about him. But I hope this is some kind of virtual monument to him that will live on the internet for years to come.
Thanks, Jeremy. That's super kind. I mean, I'm really glad that you had this idea to do this, and I'm amazed I made this through without shedding a tear. I think this is maybe the first day I've gone without being sort of ambushed by sorrow. I mean, he passed on July 26th, and it's been pretty. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just sort of the sorrow you feel is proportional to the love you felt for the man. And I just blame him for one thing, though, is that we had such a wonderfully uncomplicated relationship that it's made me, like, it's deprived me of, I think, that one source for writerly inspiration that seems to be
fucked up relationship with your father.
Yeah, man. Thanks, Dad.
Well, that's what you can hate him for. You've right. got it in
I got
full,
it.
Circle.
Yeah. Full circle. Full circle. I'll draw on that as inspiration.
Okay, well, Kaiser, thank you so much. And again, love to you and all of your family at this
Thanks,
time.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, David.
Thank you, David.
Yes, great pleasure.
We'll see you next week on the Seneca Podcast.